everybody who registered should have received a copy of the presentation. If you are calling in and you did not pre-register, you can still get the presentation by going to our website. That's www.uucef.org. So it stands for UU Common Endowment Fund, uucef.org. And if you go to that page over in the right-hand column, you will see a link to the presentation for this call. So we have two other people who will be presenting today, Kathleen Gaffney, who is the chair of our UUA Investment Committee, and Kathy Mulvey, who is the chair of the UUA Socially Responsible Investment Committee. The agenda for the day is, first of all, to talk about the performance review. We'll be looking at both the year-end numbers, that is through December 31st, which has some ugliness to it. December was a terrible month. And then also we'll look at the more recent report through January, which has a little bit better news. So a little spoiler there. Sorry about that, Kathleen. And then we'll talk about the investment committee that we just had last week and what the committee addressed, and then we'll open it up to your questions and answers. So with that, let me turn it over to Kathleen.
So welcome again, everyone. And I'm going to start reviewing performance on the third page, which is headed Total Fund Return versus Peer Universe Gross. And as Tim mentioned, we're going to be looking at different sets of numbers. The numbers in front of you are through year end, so as of December 31, 2018. And what we have here is the long-term performance. So on the left-hand side, the most recent quarter, followed by our fiscal year-to-date through 12/31, the last 12 months, 3-year, 5-year, 7-year, and 10-year. And then below that, you have the table of returns. At the third line from the bottom, you'll see composite with a blue circle on the left. That is the UUCEF. So we're looking at our performance versus our peers. So all other endowments, regardless of their guidelines, that are in the size of $50 million to $250 million. And the UUCEF is just under $200 million, about $185 million right now, I believe. Yeah. So looking at the most recent performance of fiscal year to date and the most recent quarter, it has been a challenging period of time. I think we all remember what December felt like, and you can see that in the numbers. So looking at the second column for the fiscal year to date, we were down 6%, which was in the third quartile or below median. So it was a tough period, but also very short term. I want to emphasize how we've done over the long term. So if we look at the 1 year, last 12 months, and the 3 year, you will see that the composite was in the second quartile for both those periods, 1 year and 3 year. So a much longer time frame. And then extending it all the way out to 10 years, you also see that our performance with our peers is in the second quartile. So strong performance over the long term and willing to deal with some short-term choppiness in order to achieve our long-term goals. And you can see that the annual return over the 10 years has been 8.5%. So a strong performance record that allows us to meet our spending policy needs. Moving on to the next slide, you'll see the same type of format, total fund return versus our peers, gross, but this is on a year-by-year basis. And what leads us to those long-term numbers, being able to generate 8.5% over the last 10 years, is the ability to not be median all the time and recognizing there are going to be markets where we underperform, but generally wanting to see a pattern where more of the time we are above the median by a large margin, and when we're underperforming, a smaller differential. So helping us to protect on the downside, but capture as much upside as we can. And that comes from our disciplined approach, working with our consultant to be diversified and to take the appropriate risk. So those long-term numbers bear out the strategy that we've been doing and the managers that we've selected. I'm moving on to the fifth page now, which has a different heading. It's the Unitarian Universalist Association. And if you look on the right-hand side, you'll see that it says, as of January 31. So yes, the fiscal year and the fourth quarter were tough numbers and they were negative numbers. But what's interesting is to see that in just 1 month, January, the market snapped back quite quickly. And the biggest difference you'll see to make that obvious is to look in the middle of the page, the column that's headed fiscal year to date. So this is through January 31. And we turned it from a gross of negative 6 to a slight positive of 0.1 on a gross basis. In large part, and this is where the manager's selection really comes in, you'll see as you go down the page, we're looking at our equity return, and they're broken out into domestic equity and international equity on this page. The equity percentage is just under 60%, 31% domestic, 27.3% international, so just over 58%. But on the domestic side, we generated a negative one-tenth versus the broad market, the Russell 3000, which was down three-tenths of a percent. All of our domestic equity managers contributed to that solid performance, particularly Rumline and Sands. Wellington SMID and Kennedy Capital, which are small cap strategies that had a tougher time during that period, yet still on a relative basis, meaning they did better than the broad market. And that's what allowed us to post that performance. And clearly, the rebound in January, much of that can be attributed to Sands coming in at 14.8% up for the month. On the international equity side, the managers produced a return of negative 2.6 versus the broad market at negative 4.1. So on a relative basis, we did better than the market, even though we were still down a bit as the international market underperformed. All of our managers did better than the market other than Boston Common, and MFS did relatively well, though down 4.9, and Baxter Street with a small negative. RBC, which is an emerging markets equity manager, actually produced a positive 4.5% return relative to the emerging market index, which was down 0.5%. This is a relatively new allocation. As you can see, we only have performance for the last 12 months, but is something that we've done over the last little more than a year, working with our consultant and recognizing that emerging markets is a long-term good opportunity. And so that has served us well. I want to pause just to make sure if anyone has any questions, please feel free to interrupt me at any time. And if not, I will go on to the next page, which will take us through primarily our fixed income allocation, which is...
Excuse me.
Yes.
You're comparing these against indexes. Where would I see those index numbers you're comparing us to?
Okay. So do you want me to go back to the equity as well to point that out as well? Okay.
Well, so on any of these, the one you just did, you compared our performance to index performance. I don't see that as a call.
Right. So going back to that prior page, you'll see domestic equity composite. So that's all of our managers together.
Mm-hmm.
And I was referencing fiscal year, fiscal year to date, down negative one-tenth.
Uh-huh.
Do you see that? And then just below that, it's negative 0.3.
Oh, the Russell 3000. Okay.
Right. Now, so that we use the, so with the domestic equity, we compare it to the Russell 3000, which is that index. But you'll notice, Rumline, because they're an index manager, but they're also ESG using our screening criteria. We bench them specifically to the Russell 1000 value, whereas Sands, the manager below that, is the Russell 1000 growth. So looking at the benchmark that we're using tells you a little bit about that strategy, what their bias is.
I get it.
It's a good question, and so I hope that helps everyone. So I'm going to go back to a page forward to fixed income, where fiscal year to date, the fixed income composite, so all of our managers, produced a return of 2.5%, and the broad market, which the index that we use for the broad fixed income market is the Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Aggregate. So that is a combination of U.S. Treasuries, primarily mortgage backs, and then investment-grade corporate bonds. So that's the benchmark that we use there. And so we were close, but a little bit behind for fiscal year to date. Looking back at the longer-term performance, the fixed income has been...
All guests have been muted. All guests have been unmuted.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, the operator keeps telling me I've either been muted or unmuted. Apologies for the confusion.
It's my fault, Kathleen.
No worries.
Yeah.
Well, so are the guests muted or unmuted now?
You're unmuted, so please keep
mute.
The noise down so that everybody can hear.
Well, I can mute myself, right?
Yeah, you can. Star 6.
So on the fixed income side, fiscal year to date, close to the benchmark numbers, but quite different performance from the different managers. So the Loomis portfolios, Loomis Multisector and Strategic Alpha, underperformed, mainly because with the downturn in the equity markets in both October and December, credit spreads for corporate bonds moved down in price more than treasuries, and there was a bit of a flight to quality. And Brandywine, which is a top-down global manager focusing on sovereign bonds, had a position in the Mexican peso, which held them back. But Franklin Templeton, similar to what was happening on the equity side of the portfolio, had significant outperformance, up 4.8% versus their benchmark of the multiverse, which incorporates some high yield and emerging market. And Franklin Templeton's expertise and knowledge of emerging market debt was a big driver of that outperformance and one of the reasons why it's incorporated into our allocation. The two Breckenridge portfolios are there to represent the broad market, so corporate and treasury, and performed very well as you would have expected in a more volatile risk-off market for debt. We continue to expect that the fixed income markets will be somewhat volatile as the Fed unwinds its balance sheet, but we think because of the makeup of the different strategies that we have, that we're well positioned to make it through this market in the long run. We have an opportunistic sleeve, and the bulk of those assets has been in GMO, which I have mentioned on previous call, and we have made a decision that with a bit of a rebound in January and the strategy not really performing as we expected, that we will be reallocating or distributing those assets across most likely both the equity, the fixed, and the private market assets. Part of what we discussed at the joint committee level was reviewing our consultants' asset allocation forecast for the next couple of years and trying to determine where best to redistribute those assets. So we haven't made that official decision yet. That will be happening between the meeting that we just had and the next one coming up. So most likely on the next call, I'll have an update for you there. And then on the last page of our January performance report, you will see the list of the modest amount of assets that we have in private markets, so either private equity or private debt. And these are strategies that deliver a return on a long-term basis and are invested in increments over time. So I think it's with this section, it's more important to know where we're making the investment and that we are working towards making progress, getting to our policy target, but we are being very selective because the private markets valuations are less attractive, and we're trying to make sure that when we make an investment that it is more aligned with our mission, given that valuations are less attractive. And then, of course, we have our allocation to community development and the cash for liquidity purposes. So we've gone through some choppy periods, but our managers are delivering strong performance. If you look on the commentary page on the next slide, fund commentary, choppy short-term markets, but our long-term, whether you look at the very long 10-year or smoothing out the returns on a one-year basis, put us in a very good position relative to our peers and able to deliver both in terms of returns but also in alignment with our UU values, which is also a big focus of the committee's time last week. Before I move into what exactly went on at our two-day get-together, I will point out that we made a commitment to a private equity manager, Generation. And this is a good example of a firm that's putting their capital towards climate solutions, so more aligned with our values, but we think will also generate a good long-term return. So progress being made on that front. Before Kathy and I get into discussing the workshop that we went into the day before our committee meeting, I will pause just to see if anyone has any questions about performance.
Could I ask a question?
Please.
Yes, this is Nancy Chaddock calling. I am overwhelmed with glee to learn that you're going to reallocate or think about reallocating the opportunistic portion of the portfolio, which has the policy percentage of 20%. I've been relieved to see that it's down to 14%, and now and because of last year's performance, I see I was wondering what direction you were going in, and I'm really overwhelmed to learn that you are going to reconsider that 20% of the portfolio to your fixed and equity portions, because it has been not transparent enough to me, and not that I understand entirely what was included in opportunistic, but I'm relieved to see that we might be moving into more traditional markets for the future. And I do recognize, for instance, the private equity, the importance of that, because fewer companies now are going public, new companies, and so private equity is an important field to be watchful for. So I would just be interested in learning a little bit more about there was a big difference between the 14% actually allocated to opportunistic versus the 20% policy. And that perhaps performance, I was wondering if performance has led you to this or if you have other long-term views looking forward.
Nancy, that's a good question. The 20%, I think going back, Tim, correct me if I'm wrong, we had another position in a global tactical asset allocation strategy that we removed at least over a year ago.
Yeah.
And so that took it down, and we've been very focused on trying to decide on what to do specifically with the GMO, recognizing that in a real volatile market, they tend to do better. And clearly, producing a 5% return in January was helpful, but they're still underperforming their benchmark. So that's the decision to reduce that. And Stevian, which is really a strategy that it is opportunistic, but it's primarily European equities, that you're going to see folded into the international equity roster. So that will quickly take that down to 10%, and it's really just deciding what to do with the GMO allocation. So I appreciate your comments. We've been aware of that, and I do think this will help simplify and the strategy so that we can better articulate, and it's easier to see what the individual managers are contributing to the performance and where it's allocated. So thank you.
I had a question.
Sure.
Bill Hardin from Wilmington. On your fund commentary chart, the first bullet talks about ranking 68th in the endowment universe. I don't think that's a percentile. If I'm right, how many are in the endowment universe?
Oh, that is a very good question.
Yeah, but it is a percentile, so that's,
oh,
that's
it is.
The answer.
Okay.
Yeah, and I forget exactly how many. This is Tim speaking. I forget, what is it?
It's It is. It's number. Well, it's showing. It's showing for the fourth quarter. Actually, looking. It is 88 portfolios. So if you go back to that slide, you'll see in between number of portfolios. So that's correct, right. So it's an 88 total.
That's not really precise to say rank. It should say percentile rank.
Okay. Now I'd still like to know how many actually are in the universe.
88.
That's the number. Okay, fine.
And you will see that on the slide in between the percentiles and before you get to composite the composite performance.
Okay.
Excellent. Any other questions?
Yeah. Hi. This is Scott Rubin from the Susquehanna Valley Congregation. I had a question on slide 5 in the international equity piece. Looked like from the 5 years forward that Boston Common has pretty consistently underperformed both the index and the MFS portfolio, which are you're both benchmarking against the same index. And I'm, wondering what the thinking is about still keeping Boston Common there after such a long period of underperformance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is a very good point, and that was actually one of the issues that NEPC, our consultant, raised, and we're discussing that. An option that as we review what we can do in redistributing the assets, that may be something that we do. Boston Common does apply an ESG screen, but we do recognize that the longer term numbers are not as compelling as what we're getting with MFS. So that is an issue that we are aware of and are discussing, and appreciate your highlighting that. Okay, so Kathy, shall we jump into all the work that we did last Thursday?
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay. Sure. Do you want to kick it off, or would you like me to?
I'll tee it up, and then let you jump in. Just
great.
To frame it, what we did on Thursday, unless, Tim, you want to add anything as well. I don't want to cut you out.
No, go ahead.
So we typically meet one day a quarter. The SRIC meets, we meet all together, and then the IC meets, but everyone is welcome to attend the entire meeting. It can be a very long day, however. As we've been working on integrating the two committees and working towards a policy statement that will serve both committees well, and primarily that is a focus on how do we build in our UU values into our investment policy. And crafting that policy comes specifically from the socially responsible investment committee's guidelines. And so we've been working on drafting those. And with the statement of conscience that came out of GA in 2017, we are adding or looking to incorporate language into those guidelines that reflects our mission to combat social justice and racial injustice and dismantling white supremacy. And we're discussing, how best we can do that. And as I'm sure you can imagine, in any Unitarian Universalist discussion, there is a broad array of opinion, and we also want to make sure that we're getting it right. So on Thursday, We all came together, the two committees, along with Tim and Tim Brennan and Susan Halbert, to discuss this with the help of facilitators, essential partners. And it was really an incredible day where over the 2 years that we've been working on integrating, we've come away with, I think, some common language about how we manage the portfolios. And much of that centers around the risk that we're taking and what our objectives are. And risk, what we learned on Thursday, so essentially what we did is we had an anti-racism training workshop that was geared specifically to our committee work and what our focus is. And you'll notice that one of the bullet points, the heading is bring values into action, and that is exactly what we want to do. And part of the biggest discussion was around what kind of risk tools do we use. We're very accustomed, particularly on the ICE, the investment committee side, of working with the fundamental risks of diversification and liquidity and equity risk. Those traditional risks do serve us well in terms of our manager selection, but they don't guide us sufficiently in terms of determining our screening criteria and making other investment decisions. And Essential Partners really helped us clarify and come away with some opportunities to further discuss what else we can do as an integrated team, recognizing our different areas of expertise that will allow us to do that. And it really was an incredible day that I think we were all really pleased with. And I will turn it over to Kathy to share a bit more.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Kathleen. And just to echo that, it was a really, really powerful day, and I think put us in a really broad way of thinking about how to invest in a way that's consistent with and advancing our UU values, while also moving us toward the risk and return objectives of the fund. And I think that, while we've been really implementing in a cutting edge way, both positive and negative screening, shareholder advocacy and engagement, and community investing over decades, really, and helping to develop the field of socially responsible investing, this was really pushing us as a committee to think about how can we maximize the leverage that we have with our investment portfolio on behalf of the UUA and congregations to advance our values in ways that will get resources to communities that have been most disadvantaged, including communities of color in the U.S. And so we had some really great discussions about how we define risks and the what the risks of opportunity costs to communities of color and low-income communities when people are not getting resources to create jobs and housing and educational opportunities, and also thinking really about how we quantify our return in financial terms, but also characterize that return in terms of the stories of people and communities where our values are coming into action. And I think so we had these sort of three-legged stool where we were talking about risks, returns, and also accountability, and being accountable to the investors in the fund, to the UUA at large, and also thinking about people who aren't represented and haven't been represented in the rooms where financial decisions are made in our society. So it was a it's a really powerful process, a step along the way toward further integrating our two committees, as Kathleen said, and also in line with the broader work that the association is doing on racial justice and dismantling white supremacy. Should I move into some of the specifics around advocacy and engagement, or do we want to?
Do
folks have any?
Kathy,
Tim, you want to add something?
I wanted to add one thing. Well, two things, I guess. One was the way this, you know, you talked about this as part of the integration of the two committees, and the way this meeting was facilitated, it really opened people up. And so, we tend to be kind of all business when we sit down to our meetings and clip through the agenda and get everything done. At this meeting, I think the people really bonded more because we opened ourselves up more, and so I thought that was important. But then the second thing I wanted to say, the other person who was there were two other people at the meeting that Kathleen, you didn't mention. One was our consultant.
I'm sorry.
So I thought it was
right.
Great to have
right.
Our consultant there. Somebody was talking. Great to have our consultant there and getting on the same page with us. And then the second person was Alandria Williams, who is the one of the co-moderators of the Association of the General Assembly and also, therefore, a co-chair of the UUA board. And Alandria pointed out something that I thought was powerful, which was that the kind of traditional financial tools, risk analysis tools, would tell us that communities of color are high risk and should be avoided in investments. And so the point is that you really need to examine the tools you use. And some of these traditional tools actually lead us in the wrong direction on justice and may actually also lead us away from good investment opportunities. And the example I'd give is that in 2008, when the world was coming across and all these banks were collapsing because of subprime loans, our community investments, which invest in communities of color and financially distressed communities, actually held up, and we did not have one default. So I think it brings the point home that you really have to not just accept all the traditional tools, but actually examine them, and where does that lead us, and is it leading us in the direction we want to go? So that was an important insight that had not occurred to me that I learned at the meeting. So, Kathy, you want to go ahead with the rest of your report?
Sure. Happy to do that. So we also had the chance, both with the SRI committee and in the joint committee, to catch up on where we are with shareholder advocacy and engagement. And as I said, the UUA has done advocacy and engagement on a range of environmental, social, and governance issues with companies. Our priority areas in recent years have been related to climate change and specifically pursuant to the fossil fuel divestment business resolution that passed the General Assembly in 2014, as well as democratic perspectives, and that includes political spending and lobbying disclosure advocacy with companies, and then work on issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and specifically we have in recent years worked on LGBTQ rights. And so as you'll see from the slide 11, I think it is, the EUA has filed or co-filed 7 shareholder resolutions this annual meeting season, and most of these annual meetings will take place in kind of the April-May time period. And the companies with the asterisk here are those that are on the Carbon Underground 200 list. That is the companies that have the largest fossil fuel reserves in the world. And so we can see that we've been working on the climate risk issue with Marathon Oil, and then on lobbying and political expenditures, which with Exxon Mobil and Valero, the question of their political spending and the alignment of their political spending really highlights climate change policy and how these companies have sought to have used their political leverage and influence in ways that block the low carbon transition and policies that will help us to slow climate change. So those are really important, and there is, as in recent years, there's a lot of attention around the ExxonMobil annual meeting coming up at the end of May, with the New York State Common Retirement Fund and the Church of England continuing to lead a lot of the shareholder advocacy engagement with the company to really make it walk the walk as it talks the talk about the Paris Climate Agreement. So folks might have seen some coverage over the weekend of efforts by ExxonMobil to stifle shareholder debate and keep a resolution about calling on the company to set short, medium, and long-term targets consistent with the Paris goals of keeping global temperature increase well below 2 degrees off the proxy statement. And we will see what happens with that and whether the Securities and Exchange Commission lets shareholders vote on that. With Tim's leadership, we also continue to dialogue with a set of companies that are identified as by the Climate Action 100 Plus Initiative, which is the institutional investors with more than $32 trillion in assets under management that are pressuring some of the highest emitting companies to take action on climate change. So you can see there the companies that we've been focused on there. So it is, as always, a busy shareholder meeting and season, and some of the lessons learned of recent years has been to really kind of step up our attention, and we had some great success with Range Resources last year with the resolution and doing an exempt solicitation memo to urge other shareholders to vote in favor of the resolution. So we're looking at ways to continue to do that this year with this array of resolutions. Tim, do you have anything that I missed there that we should be highlighting?
Just a couple quick additions. Marathon Oil, we asked them to do this 2-degree scenario analysis, which essentially is to say how can their company operate in compliance with a path towards the Paris Agreement, and they agreed to do it, and they're going to do the report exactly as we asked and follow the international standard, which is called the TCFD. So that, I think, is exciting. And then on the two lines down, Valero also agreed to our proposal and will be issuing a report on their political expenditures following the standards set by the Center for Corporate Accountability. So I think that's pretty significant.
Great. As always, a great impact with that advocacy and engagement.
So I think that's our report. There's a little bit of time left if folks would like to ask some questions. I mean, there are a lot of people on the line, so there's some ambient noise. If you'd hit *6, that would mute your phone. But if someone would like to offer a question, please step up.
Hello, this is Tim Miller in Durango, Colorado. I had a question on the bringing values into action slide.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I'm just wondering what portfolio changes might we anticipate as a result of broadening the risk tools? I mean, would it be more emphasis on community development, more traditional investments, but still with the SRI type filters? And where is the tipping point between doing good and you know, earning good, you know.
Well, I think, you know, you ask exactly the right question, and that is, you know, the charge to our committees, which is to carry all those things and come up with an outcome that does deliver, you know, good returns to our congregations so they can meet their obligations. So I think we didn't get way down the road on this. This is kind of a new way of thinking. You know, so this is just me speaking now. This is not a decision of the committee. But, you know, one thing we touched on was, should we perhaps be doing a little bit more in the community investing space? And we actually looked at a couple of opportunities that specifically address communities of color. So that's a possibility. We have also recently looked at a private equity investment that would put money in the hands of entrepreneurs of color. It didn't meet our thresholds on certain criteria, so we did not move on that. But we're interested in other similar kinds of opportunities. So our consultant knows that and is looking for those. But if we, you know, if we move in that direction, we would expect to, you know, find funds that are prepared to, you know, move capital in that direction while still delivering competitive returns. Kathleen, are there other takeaways, or Kathy, that you'd like to point to?
I would just point out that the specific example of being able to deliver good returns with our values is Rumline, who is using our screening criteria and is an index manager. And if you ever wondered how an index manager can outperform, it is by using that screening criteria, which brings me to the second point that part of expanding our tool set and the whole movement in the markets towards better understanding the risks that accompany environmental, social, and corporate governance issues is that can be measured and considered in your investment analysis. And Sustainalytics, which I think we talked about on either the last call or the call before that, is the company that we work with that helps us identify and adjust our screening criteria, which is one of the best tools we can use right now to really reflect different types of factors. And I say factors because the more data that's available on a company level, the easier it is to attribute the specific ESG risks that are incorporated in a company's business model. And that will give us, as someone who's very much steeped in the traditional fundamental process, it's really just breaking down the risks that you're taking and knowing them better and being able to leverage that information that I think, one, allows you to reflect your values, but at the same time, do it in a way that doesn't hold you back, but in fact, could actually improve your returns. And it's going to take some time to demonstrate that, but the more managers and the more investors that gravitate towards taking a more nuanced look at what the real risks really are, and that moving towards better practices and governance, no matter what the issue, is better for all of us and will lead towards better returns. So I think we have our long-term performance and some of the specific managers that we're working with and the work that we've done with Sustainalytics gives me a lot of confidence that as we move forward, looking at what additional tools we can incorporate, we're doing it in a very disciplined way. And if you notice on the last bullet point, which I didn't address on the bringing values into action, is It is also very important to all of us, staff and the IC and the SRIC, to communicate always through this phone call, conference call, through other areas of communication that we have to let everyone in our community know what we are doing, and that the more people that are informed and knowledgeable of it, the better we will be. So this is one step that we've taken, and we will continue to talk to you and inform you of what we are doing so it's clear and transparent for everyone.
Yeah, the other thing, last thing I'd add, unless Kathy, you want to talk about I think it was called Transform Finance, the meeting that we had a couple representatives at. Do you want to address
that? Go for
it,
Tim.
So the point is that when it comes to this issue of looking at investments through a racial justice lens, this is kind of new. I mean, there's been some work on this in the past, but this is largely new. But we are not alone. This is not the UUA out there on the edge doing this by ourselves. In fact, there was a meeting at the Rockefeller Foundation, which is a huge foundation, that brought together a bunch of foundations and other values-based investors to talk about this. We had two representatives at the meeting, and there's some concrete steps that are coming out of that, and that group is going to continue to work together to try to figure out how to integrate racial justice more thoroughly into the investment process. So I look forward to what comes out of that group, and we will be participating in that going forward. Any other questions?
Yeah, this is Bill Hardin from Wilmington. I think on an earlier call, somebody mentioned that actually, I don't know, 60-70% of the portfolio was influenced in some way by our values, you know, not just the few percent that is at the bottom there. Is that still true?
Yeah, it's I would actually say it's 100%. So the number you're referring to is correct. It's about 80% of the portfolio. The managers explicitly incorporate environmental, social, and governance issues into their process. So that's now north of 80%. But I say 100% because even on that remaining 20%, you know, when we went and looked for those managers in particular asset classes, we didn't see opportunities where managers were explicitly incorporating ESG. But when we interview those managers, we are asking them questions about, you know, the ethics of their firm, the diversity of their firm. So we're bringing the UUA values to bear in each and every of our decisions. But yes, I think over the years, we've made a lot of progress in finding managers who are explicit in their incorporation of ESG.
Hello?
Yep. Go ahead.
This is Steve White from Santa Monica. Our church has made some deposits with a local community investment institution that is explicit. It's a credit union that's explicitly focusing their loans to low-income and
terrific.
Other impoverished areas. What can you say about the relevance of that as either a potential investment for the UUA or some parallel to what we're doing with CEF investments?
Well, part of the Common Endowment Fund is invested in community investments, which is exactly what you are talking about.
Right.
And so we are not in the one you're talking about, but we have about 40 different investments in different microfinance funds, community investment funds, and credit unions. So, yes,
okay.
That's an important part of what we do, and we may grow that over time.
Okay.
And, Tim, Sorry, just this is Kathy. Just to add to that, when congregations make community investments, there is an opportunity for a match by the UUA, by the Common
Endowment
Correct. Fund.
Correct. Oh. Yes. Yeah, so up to $10,000, if a congregation documents that they've made a community investment of $10,000 or more, then the UUA will make a parallel investment of up to $10,000. And if you're interested in more, if you look at the website, uucef.org, on the reports drop-down menu, about a third of the way down, it says holdings and community investments. And you can see exactly what we've invested in. It's all disclosed there.
Credit union seems to be a rapidly expanding and consolidating out of the credit unions with annual report of social impact and so forth.
Yep, agreed. Yeah, it's good work. So with that, I'm looking at 2:58, so we're really up against the hour. I want to thank particularly Kathleen and Kathy for joining the call and speaking and for their work on the committees. We really appreciate that. And I want to thank all of you on the call for joining the call. It's great to have your interest, and your congregations are certainly well served by your diligence in monitoring your investment in the Common Endowment Fund. And then lastly, I just invite anybody who did not get a chance to ask a question, feel free to shoot me an email. There's contact information on the presentation that was distributed on the last page. There's my contact information and Susan Helberts, who's the assistant to the treasurer, and either of us would be happy to answer questions that you might have. So thanks, everybody, and have a good rest of your afternoon.